Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, sitting in for Chris Boyd. So there's a reason cowboy boots have heels, just like there's a tail behind those copper rivets that are attached to the corners of your jean pockets. Much of today's fashion was born from function. So in a time when what we wear is usually just for fashion and not for function, it can be hard to choose between the single and double-breasted dinner jacket, the bow tie or the skinny tie, the turtleneck or the scarf. So here to shed light on your wardrobe and add a little bit of color is G. Bruce Boyer. He's one of the most influential menswear writers of our time and author of the new book, True Style: The History and Principles of Classic Menswear. Bruce, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Lauren. It's wonderful to be with you today.
So I have to ask by asking you, since you're in a studio in Pennsylvania, what are you wearing?
See, you shouldn't have asked that because you know the old joke that I have a face made for radio.
Well, I assumed you wouldn't be in your pajamas, though. I know you have quite a reputation.
It's not too far a step above that. Actually, I'm wearing old khakis and a pair of deck shoes and a Shetland crew neck sweater and a button down shirt. You know, I'm very old school. I'm Ivy League forever in a way, I guess. I'm imprisoned by the tastes of my youth to some extent.
Oh, interesting. So you don't change with the trends very much. You're holding it steady.
Well, that's one of the things that I talk about and that I actually have always recommended to guys, and I think it's made me the black sheep of the fashion industry because I keep telling guys, buy the best clothing you can afford, you know, good quality, and keep it forever, and don't let your wives or your girlfriends or your mothers throw it away. Maybe you know this old saying, when you buy quality, you only cry once.
Yes. But then you also have to make sure you can fit in it 10 years later, and that can be a challenge for some people.
Listen, I'm glad you brought that up. It's the best diet in the world. It's the best diet there is. You buy very, very good clothing, and you get a nice wardrobe together, and then you have to be able to fit into the clothes. So
interesting.
Yeah, I know. Whenever I gain a pound or two, I know I have to go on a diet because I can't afford to buy new clothes every year. I think that's for me, that's the most foolish and expensive thing you can do.
Interesting. So in your book, you also talk a lot about history, and we'll get to fashion advice or to style advice, better said. But in your book, right, you connect major historical events with changes in men's fashion. Go back and tell me how the Industrial Revolution changed what men wore.
Sure. There in the end of the... Let me see. I would say 18th century, you know, particularly since the French Revolution, there were two important revolutions at the turn into the 19th century, the French Revolution in 1789 and then the Industrial Revolution, which was ongoing. And before that, men, certainly men who had money, men of the aristocracy and peerage and richer people, men and women dressed not too differently in the sense that they wore satin garments and silk garments, powdered wigs, silver buckles on their shoes. But with the Industrial Revolution, more and more people started to crowd into cities. you know, the beginning of the 19th century is also the rise of the huge cities. I think probably between 1750 and 1800, the size of London, for example, which was at the time, I think, the largest city in the world, probably doubled. Now, when you put all of those people together in a city that's becoming dirtier and grimier, silks and satins don't work too well. So men started to turn away from that kind of gorgeousness in dress, if you will, and started to wear more black broadcloth. And that became the business uniform. And it's kind of still what we wear today. And all of this started at the beginning of the 19th century because of the growth of cities and the rise of an industrial class of people.
I read online a description I liked that said men's fashion became something like a series of undecorated black tubes, like the smokestacks of the Industrial Revolution.
Well, it's true. You know, that's an interesting way of putting it, but it's absolutely true that men, you know, between 1700 and 1800, the styles changed enormously. You almost wouldn't recognize men as being the same species if you looked at those two different periods.
Let's talk scarves for a minute. Just how far back in history do men's scarves go?
Oh, my goodness. You know, there was a recent find. When I say recent, I mean within the past 50 years, because I tend to think in those terms, right? I forget what the name of it is now. But you know the terracotta Chinese soldiers?
Yes.
That were discovered? I mean, that huge army of terracotta soldiers that was discovered in China as Chinese farmers were plowing their fields. Well, those soldiers, I think, went back, a couple of thousand years. And the interesting thing for scholars is to study these things and see what they were wearing. Well, one of the things that a lot of these warriors were wearing were neck scarves.
Hmm.
Now, the question then is, you know, why were they wearing them? And interestingly enough, about 2,000 years ago, during the Roman Empire, there was a large bas-relief statue put up in Rome. It's still there. You can still see it. And on it were carved Roman warriors, and they also were wearing neck scarves. And the question becomes, was it, a kind of badge of honor, or was it a fashion, or was it for protection? And my conclusion, without knowing as much about it as I should, because I'm not a scholar of ancient periods, is that it probably was for protection in two ways, in that the scarf kept you warm, for one thing, but also the main weapon used was the sword. And it probably, kept the sword away from the neck a little bit, at least.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm not sure how much. I do know that the scarf, at least in men's fashion, and you say this, that it has served a very specific purpose. Is it true that early aviators considered scarves essential flight equipment?
Yeah, I think that they did. And there, I mean, it certainly kept you warm. But I think it was more of a kind of badge of honor, just like the various kind of jackets that they wore were. But the most important use of the scarf in modern history was that it became the necktie. And this again goes back to the Industrial Revolution. and a man whose name everybody knows, Beau Brummel, the great Regency dandy of the period. He made the neck scarf the kind of focal point of his whole outfit. And it's because of him that I think the scarf becomes so important at the beginning of the 19th century.
Now, these days, whenever I'm in a restaurant or a cafe and I see a man wearing a scarf and it's not winter, I like to try and guess where he's from, because I've found that more often than not, it's from another country.
Yes.
Why does it seem like American men have such an aversion to scarves, at least not during winter?
It's interesting. You know, this is the way I actually start off the book, by saying that American guys simply don't know what to do with their necks. You know, a lot of them have given up wearing neckties, either long foreign hand ties or bow ties, and it's very difficult to get them to wear ascots or anything like that. So when you see a guy in a restaurant and he's wearing a scarf and you wonder about him, my rule of thumb would be 3 out of 4 chances he's from France.
You know? Yep.
It's, right?
Or Spain, French, or Italy, or yeah.
Yeah, but the French have absolutely made an obsession and an art out of tying ties, tying the scarf around the neck. If you walk around Paris, you see the most wonderful ways that guys tie scarves. The only thing that bothers me about it is you wonder if some of these guys spent the whole morning doing it, you know, instead of doing any productive work. But
and you mentioned the ascot. I'm embarrassed to say, I had to look that up to find out what the ascot is. Describe it.
Yeah. Well, the ascot takes its name from the famous English horse race, the ascot, which was the name of the place where it was run. But it's really a band of silk material about 6 inches wide and about a yard long, and you fold it around over into quarters, let's say, and wrap it around your neck, and then you tie it loosely and put it in place with a pin, and it's worn with what's called formal day wear. In other words, a swallowtail coat, which is kind of like a tailcoat, and light gray trousers, and a gray top hat, and it's worn for formal day occasions. You know, so it's kind of it's kind of like just a scarf that you would tie around your neck, except that it takes a pin to hold it into place in the front.
And it's also, I saw, the thin orange tie that Fred wears around his throat in Scooby-Doo. That's how I recognized it.
Okay.
But in any case, we'll get on to scarves a little bit more in a minute. You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in today for Chris Boyd. This hour, fashion and the evolution of a man's wardrobe. We're talking with G. Bruce Boyer, longtime menswear editor for Town & Country and the author of True Style, The History and Principles of Classic Menswear. You can join our conversation about men's fashion. Call 800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. We'll be back with more in a minute.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can learn how to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, a customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. clothing speaks loud. The shirts and shoes we wear, their color, materials, and make, they have always served as a sign of where we fall in society, what rung on the ladder, so to speak. But to have style today doesn't require being rich. That's what our guest says. He says designers create fashion for anyone, but only the individual can create a style for himself. G. Bruce Boyer is author of True Style, The History and Principles of Classic Menswear. Bruce, whereas some fashion is top-down or given by the aristocracy, like the scarves that you've mentioned, some of those, other fashion is bottom-up. It's from the proletariat, so to speak. Give some examples of that fashion.
Well, in the beginning of the 20th century, a famous English art historian, James Laver, said that men's clothing really comes from two sources, the military or from sport. And that makes a lot of sense. But what he didn't really understand was that, you're absolutely right, a lot of clothing nowadays, and has, I would say, ever since the post-World War II era, come from the streets up instead of from the aristocracy down. If you think of jeans, for example, would be the absolute perfect example. Before World War II, very, very few people in the world, and even in this country, wore jeans except as a work uniform. I mean, real cowboys wore jeans, but very few other people did. After World War II, when jeans started to move into what we could loosely call the fashion area, you know, particularly with films like Marlon Brando's The Wild One and James Dean's Rebel Without a Cause and that kind of thing, they became proletarian statements of style. And I think that carried along until the end of the 60s. I think around 1968 and 7 and 9, you know, when you get what was called in San Francisco the Summer of Love and then Woodstock in New York, you get a real proletariat revolution. You know, the tie-dyed clothes and the bell-bottom jeans and the shearling vests and all of that kind of thing.
Yeah, you wouldn't see royalty wearing any of that.
No. Well, eventually, you know, some of them did, but it worked its way up from the bottom. And today, you know, if you look around, whether it's on the street or on the runway, you see an awful lot of, for example, you know, military jackets. I think one of the most popular garments for guys that I see these days, and you see it all over the place, is the Army field jacket, you know, that olive drab jacket, that kind of mid-thigh length with all the pockets and everything.
Yeah.
It's real prole gear.
And shoes as well. I mean, these days sneakers are just one of the biggest sort of fashion statements you can make, and that of course comes from sports.
Yes. And also all sorts of Field and Stream and military boots. You know, work boots, and climbing boots and hiking boots, those things are all over the place. You know, I would think that a company like L.L. Bean, I don't want to, you know, give any plugs because I don't really care, but L.L. Bean probably sells thousands and thousands and thousands of pairs of those duck boots. You know what I mean?
For people who aren't going duck hunting.
The leather and rubber ones.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's not because there are more people going duck hunting. It's just a fashion statement. I mean, you see people walking around Chelsea in New York or in the East Village or something, and they're dressed as though they were ready to go hunting, but they're not. You know, it's just a fashion thing.
You can join our conversation by calling 800-933-5372. We're talking about men's style and fashion. You can also send an email to think@kera.org. And Gail in Dallas, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Great. What's your question?
Well, it wasn't really a question. I'm way behind in the conversation now. You've gone way beyond scarves, but it occurred to me when you were talking about scarves that it would be so much easier if you're out in the field, and especially 2,000 years ago when these artifacts were found. But if you're out in the field, you know, you can wash that scarf in a lake or pond or whatever, and hang it up at night and still look fairly dapper the next day.
Interesting.
Because back then there was no way to wash things, you know, except by hand. So I wondered if it had some function other than protection, you know, that maybe it protected also from looking so nasty after you've been out in the field for a while and haven't been able to have your stuff washed.
Thanks, Gail. Any thoughts on washing and convenience of things like the scarf or, I don't know, another garment in terms of how easy it
is
to clean?
Sure. Well, I certainly have a thought on the convenience, and I'll give you a better example than the scarf. Everybody knows what the Scottish kilt is, but not many people realize that hundreds of years ago, the Scottish kilt was simply a very large piece of clothing that the Scotsman would wrap around his waist and let fall to below his knees during the day, and at night he would actually unwind it and curl up in it to sleep. So it was not only a suit of clothes, it was also a bed.
Wow, I would not.
You know,
have
if I can put it that way. So yeah, and you know, the Scotsman would have this big piece of cloth, which you just wrap around him, and he'd have a bag to carry some food, and he was set. You know, I mean, he could go off for days at a time, and he was set. So it's most clothing, you know, if it lasts, it's because of the convenience of it. Sure.
Because we're in Texas, or we have to talk about cowboy boots. And I was fascinated in your book. What is the reason behind the pointed toes and the heels?
Yes.
On boots.
Yes. A real cowboy boot has pointed toes. They're often called needle toes because they're so pointed, and an underslung heel and a high arch. And the reason for all three is the same, because it helps you to get in and out of the stirrup very quickly. You know, if you had a very broad front to the boot, it might catch trying to get into the stirrup. So the entry point of the boot has to be very narrow so you can get in and out of the stirrup quickly. And the high arch makes it more comfortable and easy to sit and to stand in the stirrup when you're there. The underslung heel not only keeps you in the stirrup, it keeps your foot from sliding forward and out of it. But if you're roping cattle, calves, for example, when you get a rope around a good size animal, it's going to pull on you, and those underslung heels could dig into the dirt and hold you in place better, so you didn't get pulled all over the place as easily. Yeah, I think everything about the cowboy boot, except for the decoration, has a function. You know, the height of it is obviously to keep, you know, sagebrush and brambles and thistles out of your legs. And good boots have pulls at the top, so you can get the boot on and off. And cowboy boots are an absolutely ingenious and wonderfully thought out design when it comes to clothing. And those artisans who make the highly decorated ones, that's only icing on the cake, you know, the decoration.
Yeah. So from cowboy boots to more formal wear, the suit, you outlined the history of the man's suit. It seems like it's gone through many, many stages.
Yes.
How would you give an overview of the different stages of the man's suit?
Sure. Well, I tell you, I can give you an absolutely specific time when the suit started to become popular. And if I could remember the day, I would even be able to give you the day, because we know the day because it was recorded. And I'm going to surprise you by going back to the year 1660.
Oh, wow. Okay.
In London. There was a man who was an official in Parliament. His name was Samuel Pepys. He wrote a very famous diary. I mean, famous in that it's famous to students of English literature and history. And he recorded that one day in 1660, he went to the Parliament building and the king was there. And this would have been King Charles the second, who became king in 1660. And Charles stood up in Parliament and said that starting the following week, he was not going to wear what was commonly worn anymore. And what was commonly worn was a doublet, which was kind of an overcoat, short only to the waist, and hose. Mm. He was going to wear a coat and a vest and longer trousers. And from that moment on, you really have the beginnings of the three-piece suit. It's amazing. Just started like that.
Why did he say no more?
Well, there's where people differ, but there's good evidence to feel that he was trying to get back at his greatest enemy, Louis XIV of France, who loved to wear ornate court dress, the very ornate doublets and very ornate hose. Louis XIV actually wore heels on, yes, his shoes that were painted red, and huge wigs and things. Louis was quite a dandy. And the theory that makes the most sense is that Charles, who really didn't like Louis and what he was trying to do, namely to take over England, Charles said, I'm not going to have anything to do with anything that's French anymore, including the way they dress. So he very consciously changed the way that men would dress. So to conclude this, a week later, Pepys went back to Parliament, and sure enough, everybody he saw there, all of the aristocrats, all of Charles's advisors, and Charles himself and his brother James, they were all wearing three-piece suits. I mean, we wouldn't recognize them today as, you know, what we wear today. But they were three garments, a vest and a coat and longer trousers.
Must have been great business for the tailors at that time.
Well, exactly. And the funny thing is that as soon as that session of Parliament was over, Samuel Pepys went to his tailor and ordered the outfit.
I see.
Yeah.
So how is it different today, the suit that men wear, the three-piece suit, than what we might see back, 400 years ago?
Back then? Well, the funniest thing, the thing that we really wouldn't recognize today is today the coat is longer than the vest. You know, the vest on a man's suit will come to his waist. The coat will drop down to the bottom of the buttocks or the top of the thighs. It was just the opposite in the 17th century.
The vest was longer than the jacket?
The vest went almost down to the floor, and the coat was short. And what happened over the ensuing years, up until it took about 100 years to the middle of the 18th century, the vest slowly rose, inch by inch, little by little, year by year. It crept closer and closer and closer to the waist, and the coat became longer. So they just kind of switched positions. The outer coat became long, and the vest became short. That was the big thing that you would notice.
We don't have a ton of time, but do you know why those switched?
Well, I have. There are theories about it. The biggest reason is that men's clothing, probably between the 16th century and almost the 20th century, the largest factor in determining the style of men's clothing was the horse. Yeah.
I want to get into that in just a minute. That's fascinating. Yes, that would get in a way, a long coat, I imagine. You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in today for Chris Boyd. This hour, we're talking about fashion and the evolution of a man's wardrobe with G. Bruce Boyer. You can join our conversation by calling 800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can learn how to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, specializing in human rights, organizational dynamics, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Lauren Silverman, in this week for Chris Boyd. We're talking about your wardrobe. Turtlenecks, boots, socks, and suits with G. Bruce Boyer. He's the former menswear editor for Town and Country and author of True Style, The History and Principles of Classic Menswear. Bruce, let's get to a little bit of common sense advice, a few do's and don'ts if you have them.
Okay, sure. I'm not much for rules, you know. A lot of the rules about dress, I think, are made up by advertising people. You know, they're just
to get you to buy a new wardrobe, perhaps.
Absolutely. That's the whole point. The whole point of fashion is burn your old wardrobe and buy this new thing, you know. And everybody in the fashion and advertising business will give you a million reasons why you should do that. But the bottom line, of course, is they're trying to sell you things. I have always taken the kind of the opposite approach. I think simplicity is a great virtue. You know, particularly, you know, you stop and think in the world today with the internet and online shops, shopping and everything, we have so many choices that the real hallmark of taste becomes restraint and refusal, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, yes, I'm not fond of that, but it's perfectly true. Yeah, you know, it's like the you know, you don't want to put all of your wares in the shop window. You know, load yourself up like some of the Real Housewives of Orange County or whatever. But I think simplicity is something of a virtue. I always believe in buying the best you can afford, because my feeling is that it's better to have two good pairs of shoes than six cheap ones, because, you know, the cheap shoes, they look cheap even when they're new, but the good shoes look good even when they're old. And so that means you have to stop thinking only about the initial cost of something, but how long it's going to last, you know, the longevity of it and so forth. So my rule would be, you know, never buy anything cheap. I also, just for guys, I think, you know, not only never buy anything cheap, but never buy anything shiny or synthetic either.
Okay, so the disco outfits are out for sure then.
Yeah. You know, it's just not a good idea. And finally, along with, you know, those general rules, I don't think that it's necessary to sacrifice comfort for fashion. I think that you should be comfortable in your clothes. And if you try on something and the salesman says, you know, oh, it looks great on you, and it feels too tight for you, it's not a good idea.
You can actually see Bruce take on some style risks of his own on our KERA Think Tumblr page. I saw a photo of you there, and you're really taking one bold risk with a pair of yellow corduroys, and a top that has a pattern on it. Do you ever mix patterns?
Yes, I do. This is just my own little game that I play with myself. I try to find out how many patterns I can get going without making people's eyes go around like a slot machine, you know? But it's a very dangerous thing to do. I mean, you can very easily end up looking like a clown. The secret, really, to mixing patterns is that they should all be of a different scale. You know, if you use a big check, you should use a small stripe, and, you know, vice versa, and that kind of thing.
It sounds like an art project.
Well, it is, and you know, but look at it this way, Lauren. You could have a lot worse vices, right?
Yes.
More expensive and more dangerous. And it really is kind of harmless. So, and it's a nice way to spend the time. But
I really enjoy putting together outfits, and I spend time actually doing it oftentimes, or at least I used to pick out my clothes the night before. Do you ever do that, or do you spend time?
I do that. I do put them out the night before. The other thing about me is it, and it's just a quirk. I don't take any responsibility for it. I seem to have been born this way, is that I can put things together in my mind. Mm. So sometimes when I'm trying to go to sleep, I can put together an outfit in my mind. And for some reason, I can tell exactly how it looks. But that's an aberration, I'm afraid.
I wish we all had closets like I remember watching Clueless growing up, and she had this closet that you could, you know, sort of put together the outfit. The tops would be on a rotating hangers, and then the bottoms, and you could scan until things looked like they went together nicely.
Some guys, you know, actually do that. They'll have closets, you know, kind of like the racks in the moving racks in a dry cleaner.
Yes, exactly.
You know, where it goes around and some guys put tags on everything, you know, that this shirt is to be worn with this suit, and that I think that's making more of it than need be. My advice has always been to figure out what works well for you and stick to it and try to refine it and enhance it. I mean, I just don't understand some of these guys on some of these internet sites, you know, where they talk about clothes and so forth. And I think, you know, gee, you're a good accountant or you're a good lawyer or whatever. You ought to be able to get dressed easily and go off and do a good job, you know, instead of worrying about whether your socks match your pocket handkerchief or something. I think that's a little over the top for me.
So one thing that I'm always jealous of people who live on the East Coast, because they get to do so much more layering. There's more cold weather, so you can put things together. And I know you do a lot of that. But here in Texas, it's oftentimes hot. So combining a tweed jacket and a wool tie and a corduroy pants, that's difficult. Do you have tips for men trying to do layering in hotter weather?
Well, now you're starting to throw difficult questions at me, you know. I was hoping you were going to ask me things I knew how to answer. But no, you're right. It that kind of thing is very difficult. But what I would say is I mentioned just a minute ago that I would never sacrifice comfort for fashion, is that I think good lightweight fabrics are very important. I think you can't beat, in hot weather, you can't beat good cottons and linens. And I know that guys tell me, yeah, but, you know, you wear them and they wrinkle and so forth. And I say, yeah, but, you know, I think that looks perfectly okay. I like that slightly broken in look. You know, there's something to be said for making the clothes your own, you know, instead of looking like you stepped out of a shop window somewhere. I think pure lightweight fabrics are certainly the way to go. You know, in hot, humid weather, it's almost impossible to beat a pure cotton seersucker, you know. It's wrinkled already, but that's the charm of it. So that would be my first advice. I mean, there are other things that you can do. For example, you try to pare down the fabric as much as you can. For example, you want to wear a single-breasted suit rather than a double-breasted, you know, that kind of thing. You're right. That's a difficult problem.
And we got an email from Gerald who brought us back to the function aspect of the cowboy boot. He says the decorative decorative stitching on the shaft was to stiffen it and keep it in place, not so it didn't rub your ankles. So maybe the stitching had some sort of function as well, originally at least.
He's absolutely right. He's absolutely right. Yes, I do know that is true, that because you're talking about an expanse of leather, not just a small shoe, but an expanse of leather. And in order to keep it up, you know, to keep the tops from collapsing, you do stitching. So he's absolutely right, and I'm glad he wrote in and mentioned that, because I'd forgotten that. Yes, absolutely.
So you mentioned that so much of what men wear today has been influenced by wars, from the suit to other things. What else was adapted from military clothing besides the coats?
The whole idea of khaki, you know, khaki, which happens to be a Persian word for dust. Mm-hmm. The whole idea behind khaki is camouflage, you know, and I can give you some historical information. There was a British guy who fought in both Africa and in India. His name was Harry Lumsden, and he commanded a troop of British soldiers. And they were either wearing sparkling white uniforms or red coats, you know, the scarlet coats that British soldiers wear on parade. Well, they were wearing these things in the field. And the result was that the enemy snipers were picking them off at their ease. So Lumsden thought about this and figured out that he would take these white uniforms, particularly that the men were wearing, and he dyed them in tea leaves so that they would be harder to spot. And the upshot of that was that his regiment lost fewer men than the other British regiments. So by the end of the 19th century, khaki became the color for uniforms for armies all over the world. So that's a big general thing. But think of something like the trench coat,
yes,
which is a very popular item today. You know, what I see now is that both men and women are wearing a lot of trench coats. They're wearing them shorter, you know, above the knee, but they're wearing trench coats. Well, the trench coat comes from World War I, trench warfare. The officers wore trench coats as protective clothing in the trenches during World War I. You know, so those are you know, just a couple of examples. There are,
and you write about one other one that I was interested in your book. You write about chino pants also.
Chinos are khakis. They're khaki trousers. The reason they're called chinos is because when America got into World War II, their allies against the Japanese in Asia were the Chinese. And a lot of the khaki fabric that was used for American uniforms was actually made in China.
Oh.
And so chino means Chinese, really. Chino is really just another way of looking at khaki.
Yes,
yeah,
Spanish
uniforms.
For Chinese.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Exactly.
So they're
exactly.
Essentially just khakis with a mm-hmm. different origin. I see.
Yes. Yes. A different place of production.
Uh-huh,
yeah.
Uh huh. Uh huh. Yeah. Now, one other thing that you talk about is fragrance in your book and men and perfume. And this
yes.
is one of the topics that I think comes up a lot when you're stuck in an elevator and someone smells very strongly. What advice
Absolutely.
Do you give men on choosing a fragrance?
Well, you know, it used to be when I was a kid, the only fragrances a man got were when he went to the barbershop for a haircut, they splashed a little witch hazel, you know, or a little Old Spice on his neck, and that was it. But today, if you go into, you know, a good-sized department store, Neiman Marcus, Bloomingdale, Saks, whatever, the men's grooming counters are as big as the women's, don't you think?
Yes, they are. And, you know, I'm so sorry, but we're running out of time, so I'm going to have to put some tips on our site. I will link to those. We're talking with G. Bruce Boyer. He's the longtime menswear editor for Town & Country and author of True Style. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Lauren, thank you very much.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Braylon Becton. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. Once again, I'm Lauren Silverman in for Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.